Hi, this is RJ Minnie, and you're listening to Skip to the End podcast.
Welcome to the Skip to the End podcast. This is another special edition of the podcast focusing on the MCM Birmingham Comic Con. As ever, I'm Ben.
I'm Adam.
And I'm Mark.
And on this edition of the podcast, we have an exclusive interview with RJ Mitty, one of the stars of Breaking Bad. We also speak to Ian McElhenney, one of the stars of Game of Thrones. We've also got a really interesting talk with Ewan Kant, who works for Arrow Video, who are one of the finest suppliers of cult DVDs and Blu-rays in the country, as well as Graham Humphreys, a legendary artist who has worked with Arrow Video. We've also got a chat with Colin Ford, one of the stars of Under the Dome. We also attended a panel for an upcoming British sci-fi film called The Call-Up. And as well as all that, we've got a couple of really cool prizes to give away. So let's get started.
The major guest of the Birmingham Comic Con was RJ Mitty, who is best known for playing Walt Jr. in Breaking Bad. We were lucky enough to actually catch up with him and have an exclusive interview. So this will be his actual first appearance on a UK podcast.
Yeah.
So here's the interview.
So we are here today with RJ Mitty, one of the stars of Breaking Bad, known to the fans as Walt Jr. or Flynn. So thanks a lot for sitting with us today, RJ.
No problem, man. Thank you all for having me.
Oh, you're welcome. First of all, we've heard that this is one of your first trips to England or your first time promoting the show in England.
Yes,
so,
this is.
Have you found the country so far?
Amazing. It's been really amazing, and especially this Birmingham Comic Con. MCM is doing amazing right now. Like, the costumes, the people. And, you know, I just did a Comic Con in Stockholm.
Yeah.
And the fans are so receiving and welcoming, and it's the same here.
Yeah.
And I find American fans are a little bit more hostile. I don't know why, but they are. They give this different vibe, and I find the fans here very, very kind and polite. And even when they're doing their fan geek out, they're still so lovely, and it's been really nice, and it's been fun. We've been having a good time. I'm here for a couple of days, and then I'm off to London for about 6-7 days, and then back to the States.
Cool.
So with Breaking Bad being such a fantastic series, everybody seems to absolutely love it. During the filming of Breaking Bad, what was the most kind of challenging scene for you that took the most takes, or that you found really kind of a struggle?
You know, it varies, and this is the thing, is people are always asking me, what was the most challenging film? What was the most challenging take? What was the hardest episode? And the thing about it was it wasn't exactly hard. Certain episodes were harder than others, and it was getting to the emotional level that you needed to for that scene. And that was the hard part. And we had that in quite a few different episodes. But when you have scripts like this that are unfolded in front of you, that the story is there, everything, you read it and you see it. And when you have something like that, it's seamless. You can go in and you can read this and you can see it because you know. And you know what you have to do in that scene.
So considering you've been asked that question again and again, let's flip it. What's the best scene that you filmed then, the one that you enjoyed the most, that didn't take any work, that you really enjoyed?
You know, my favorite to film in general was a pilot.
Yeah.
I love the pilot. Pilot episode's my personal favorite episode. It kicks off the story right. It kicks everything into motion. And so much happens in the first episode. It's a movie, essentially.
In literally 45 minutes, you get a two-hour film.
Yeah, you really do. And it's that type of writing that I love, and that type of energy that you can have in a film. And Breaking Bad had that through the whole thing, but you really got it in the pilot. And I love the pilot, and it's truly remarkable at what we were able to bring to that pilot. And it was literally lightning in a bottle. We could never recreate this, but we had so much fun doing it.
And whilst you were doing it, whilst you were filming the pilot, did you have any indication that it was going to be the success that it eventually became?
No, you can never know that something like this is going to be a success. You just don't. It's impossible to tell. Even when, like, we knew we had a great substance, we knew we had a good crew, we knew we had great cast. We knew this. But at the end of the day, that doesn't mean anything.
Yeah.
Like, shows get buried all the time. Things get pushed. Things never see the light of day. Amazing scripts that I read never get funding. And it happens. So it's just all about the timing. When we first started, we weren't very... People watched us, but we weren't a popular show. Because just the stigma and the timing of everything with the content of our show, people were in a different place of mind and in a different world than they are now and what they can accept now. And I feel like people are a lot more desensitized now than they used to be. Because back then, no one would ever watch a show about a high school chemistry teacher making methamphetamine. I would tell people all the time, oh, I'm on this show, and I'd tell them what they're about, and they'd be like, oh, that's horrible. Why would anyone watch that? And now those same people are like, oh my god, I love this show.
Mind-blowing.
It's the best thing ever, and I find it so interesting to see the difference.
I mean, on that kind of note, have you been quite surprised with the reception in the UK, considering it was never actually on television over here?
Yes, no. Netflix. I've gotten over the years a lot of UK, Eastern European, all over. I've gotten so many different fans from all over, I find, and luckily enough, Twitter brings that together, and Facebook and Instagram and all that. But it's like we're in a world where media is blink of an eye, and you have access, and we never had this before. And I knew, but I didn't understand how much people love the show here. And they continue to love the show, and the show is continuing... It's continuing to grow, though. It's like, even now, there's people that have finished Breaking Bad, or there's people that haven't seen Breaking Bad. And then you have these middle people that don't matter.
The wait when it came on over here in the UK, so we had it once a week, that's all we had, and you'd go to work on a Monday morning and talk about Series 5, which always ended on the biggest cliffhangers ever, and it was all people talked about. You'd walk in, you wouldn't even say, you'd just look at each other and be like, oh my god, we've got to wait a week. It's not nice
that
on this side of it.
No, but it's so worth the wait, and that's the thing though, and that's why I think changed a lot because of Netflix and because of so many things. Binge viewing is massive now.
Yeah.
And I'm a massive binge viewer. I love to binge view.
Yeah.
It's not really good for network or television. Mm. It's actually killing it, but it's amazing when you can go and you can watch a whole series in one sitting and you can get all that and just rewatch it again and again. And it's really amazing that we have all this access.
Just on the cliffhanger stuff there, we're talking about how we went into work the next day and we still, oh my god, did you see that? How under wraps did Vince keep Series 5 of Breaking Bad from you guys?
Yes and no. There was a lot of scripts that were blocked out, and we didn't question it. You didn't need to question it.
You knew what you wanted to know. We
knew our characters. We knew what our characters had to do. We did this for almost 7 years, so we had a general idea of where our characters were going, what our characters needed to do to continue the family. And we were a very character-driven show versus story-driven. And we were lucky to have that because most places are all about locking it down and following their Bible, per se. And we weren't. They were creating this story as we were going along and as we were creating the characters themselves. So
what you were just saying about the binge watching, which we're all very guilty of, I'm intrigued. We're on our podcast every week. We talk about our top three, so top three horror, TV. What's your top three TV then, apart from Breaking Bad, obviously?
I don't watch actually Breaking Bad.
I can't believe you've only watched the first episode and the last.
I don't watch anything that I'm in, but I've the last thing I was watching. I'm really bad right now. Actually, I've been traveling so much, so my viewing has been lacking. Last thing I binge viewed was Attack on Titan. But I watch a lot of movies, though. This is the thing.
What's your top three movies,
then? Oh, that's
interesting.
Easy. That's easy. Pulp Fiction, Dusk Till Dawn. And there's one more. I always keep it on loop. Cheech and Chong.
Oh, beautiful. Nice. Yeah. Throw that into the mix.
So, yeah, I keep those on loops, actually, in my house. I always have white noise, and it's either a TV series like Family Guy or something like that, or it's those movies that are always rotating.
Yeah. And just to move away from the TV and film for a moment, you mentioned in the panel that obviously you have cerebral palsy.
Yeah.
And I know that you're involved with quite a few charities. So how did you get involved with that, and how important is that to you?
My family was always in philanthropic work. My grandfather, when I was a child, started a nonprofit. called the Roy Ann and Joanne, Roy Frank and Joanne Cole Mitty Foundation. And I'm actually named after my grandfather, Roy Frank Mitty. And they've always been, it's always been really important in my family to give back to the community and give whatever you can and try to have an impact. And I grew up with that. I grew up, my family, my mom was in home health, my family was in medical field, my grandparents were in insurance and the philanthropic side and always giving back and working with Habitat and so many different amazing organizations. And I was lucky with this job, I can incorporate that into what I do. I have access. I have that awareness. I can bring people and talk to them, like I did on the panel, about disability and diversity and telling people and showing people how much influence they have and trying to remind them that they do have it, because you have so many times where people forget that they are as able to do things, like, I'm trying to think of the word, as able to do whatever they want, in a sense where people don't have strings. You have the ability to make an impact in your life and grow and show people, and people forget that. And setting an example, I find, is very important to me. And I always enjoyed working with organizations, and I grew up with Shriners Hospitals for Children. And I think there's one in the UK. I know there's one in Canada. There's quite a few all over the world, and there's a lot in the U.S. There's, I think, around 50-something in the U.S., and they have such a big impact. And they gave me the ability to walk. They gave me the abilities that I needed to be here today. So I'm really lucky that I've been working with them closely in the last little bit. And I always think it's important to try to have an impact and to show people how to have an impact. And it doesn't take a long time. It's not hard. Like, people are like, oh, you got to do all this work with a foundation. I'm like, when I sit on the board, I sit on a couple of boards, and I work with SAG and AFTRA. I'm a performer with disability, IMPWD, and then I also work with the diversity division of SAG. And I sit on the diversity board, and I also sit on the board out of Austin, Texas, my grandparents. And I do one phone call, like, every once in a while, and then I go into a meeting at least once a year for the foundation, and that's like, it's not hard. And I try to show people how easy it is to have an impact. Because if more people realize that, this world would be so much better than what it is. But you have to, like, you have to lead the horse to water.
Yeah.
Like, you have to be like that, and then you have to kind of, like, spoon it, like, you have to drown them in it.
So what's the next sort of 6 months looking like for you?
Oh, God. I've been traveling for the last 4 months, 3 months. So I'll be in London after this. I'm here for 4 days. Then I'll go to London for about six. I have a couple meetings. I'm seeing my buddies are actually, y'all know Hollywood Undead?
Yeah.
They're very good friends of mine. I've known them for years. And they're doing a show here in Birmingham. And then they're doing one in London. And they're doing it on Saturday. So we're going to go party with them in London.
It's good to hear that you're talking about Slayer and other bands. Like, it's great taste of music. It's really good to hear that.
I love music.
So final question. Have you got any gigs lined up apart from that? Are you going to a lot of gigs on that?
Yeah, I have quite a few. Or no, I gigs. No, I don't actually. I'm working. I'm trying to get some more work over here. I shot a trailer here. Actually not in the UK, in Paris, France. I shot a trailer for a movie there that we're working on, and I enjoy filming over here. The culture, the history, it just makes it such, like
we've got the history here.
You got history on every corner.
Yeah.
So, like, you can practically walk down any alley and shoot whatever the hell you want, and it's going to look amazing.
And the UK love you, so you're sold straight away.
So it's perfect. We're good to go.
Come over soon.
I'm trying. We're working on it. But it's never dull. The next 6 months are crazy. I'm hoping to get some snowboarding in.
Brilliant.
We'll see what happens.
Have a nice, well-earned break. Go to loads of gigs and chill.
I need to, man.
And catch up on your binge viewing as well.
Yes. There's a few shows that I need to catch up on that I've just been lazy. I've been really lazy. But did y'all see the Dust Till Dawn, the series?
It's on Netflix. Yeah, yeah. I started watching series one, and I'm loving it.
It's so sick, man. I watched the movie, and it's not exactly there's like flaws in it, but like it's pretty spot on when it gets down to it. Like they look so much they're perfect for it. They look so much like the characters. So
we all love the American TV stuff. We're addicted to it over here. So we binge watch The American Office, Parks and Recreation, all of it. So there's a lot of stuff out there.
I'm a big fan of a lot of British television. I like the original Skins.
Yeah.
So good. Why did we have to ruin it?
we think about that all the time. Why do Americans take British TV and ruin it?
It's so good. It's the comedy y'all have here. It's so different from our comedy. So like we try to put an American twist on it, and it just doesn't come out okay. Like we need to leave it that way.
Finally, for the listeners that are listening to this podcast, is there any websites they can go to donate to any charities that you recommend?
Yeah, if they want to donate, please. They can always. There's so many organizations out there. I'm doing an anti-bullying campaign called CutTheBull.org.
Fantastic.
And it's not to stop bullying. You will never be able to stop bullying. That's going to be a problem that we'll have for the rest of our life. But the bullying now is not what it used to be. It's gone from bullying to assault. And that's what I try to tell people and talk to people when I speak and I travel. If they want, please feel free. They don't have to donate. There is a donate page. You can sign up for free. There's so many other organizations. United Cerebral Palsy. They're PACER. Shriners Hospitals for Children.
Follow you on Twitter as well.
Follow
there's
me
a
on Twitter. There's, I please, it's just RJ Mitty. And the thing about it is, you don't have to donate to one of my charities. You don't have to follow one of my charities. I want people to find their own charity, something that they truly want. And that's the thing I find that when it comes down, and this is for the listeners, find something you truly want. When you truly speaks to you. The charities I work with, they speak to me. I know these charities. I've worked with these charities. These are charities I know that are working for me and that have worked for me and I for them. But when it gets down to it, you want to find something that speaks to you. You want to find something that you want to give to, that you want to have that cause, and people need that cause. So if when it gets down to it, don't just give, donate. Give and donate to what you want and to what you know has an impact.
And what you believe in.
Exactly.
Fantastic. So, well, we really appreciate your time today. It's been a pleasure speaking to you.
No worries. Nice definitely.
So that was our exclusive Skip to the End interview with RJ Mitty. I don't know about you guys, I thought he was a really cool guy.
He was a very cool guy, and he was obviously so happy to be here, to be in England, to be at the convention. He was having a great time.
Yeah.
We were really fortunate to be able to sit down and have that chat with him. It was fantastic.
It was amazing to see the kind of response he got as well for his panel.
Yeah.
It was absolutely baking in there, full of people.
Oh, it was packed out.
More people trying to get in.
Yeah, literally just standing on the side, just looking in, trying to see it.
It was absolutely brilliant. And to give the opportunity for the audience to ask many questions as well. And his answers were fascinating. You could listen to that guy all day.
Yeah, genuinely nice as well. I think I remember him walking into kind of the press room to meet everyone. And he literally took the time out to individually shake the hand and introduce himself to every single person in there. Whether they were staff or crew or press or whatever, he was just really adamant that he took the time to welcome everyone and say hi. I'm RJ. Who are you?
Mm-hmm.
And really get to know about each individual person in there as well.
Yeah, he was a real gentleman, and it's interesting to hear about his upcoming slate of work. You know, he's worked on Switched at Birth in the US as well as Breaking Bad.
He's got a film coming out soon called Who's Driving Doug?
Yeah. And no doubt he'll have other projects lined up. And, you know, I wish him every success in the world because he's a good actor and a damn good guy.
I remember one of the things he said during his panel that made the whole room laugh out loud, that he was obviously on crutches throughout Breaking Bad. In his most recent role, he was in a wheelchair. And he said that hopefully the next one will look like it could be in a coma.
Yeah.
He hasn't even got to get up, that's the way it's going. And I remember the whole room were just bursting out laughing.
He said, didn't he, guys, I'd love to go to work and just go to sleep.
And then wake up and go home, yeah.
Great guy.
Great guy, really good guy. And interesting to hear him kind of talk about some of his charity work there as well.
Absolutely, yeah.
He talked about how he's doing some work with an anti-bullying charity called cuttheball.org. Some very interesting thoughts on bullying as well. Quite poignant, really stuck with me as well after speaking to how bullying's kind of moved on from just, you know, abuse to kind of assault now.
Mm.
So it's interesting to see him do all the charity work for children's hospitals as well, because he mentioned they've been very good to him over the years, so he really wanted to give something back to them.
Yeah, and one of the things that interested me about his charity work is when we said to him, you know, suggest to us a charity that people can give to, and his response was, you know, find something that means something to you. Just, you know, it's not just about choose this one over this one. It's find something that resonates with you. So I thought that was really interesting.
The interesting thing for me was hearing him talk about Breaking Bad. I mean, he obviously, and as you would, looks on that so fondly.
Yeah.
And he kind of admits that something like that's never going to be repeated. You see, he uses the phrase lightning in a bottle, you know, and it's so true. It kind of just started to take the world by storm at one stage. I think around about series four, it just kind of took the world by storm, and that was it. People just grabbed it and ran with it, and even he kind of understands how difficult that is to do. So he always looks on it quite fondly, and hearing him talk about how they knew they had a good product from day one.
There's
a lot less pressure on you when you realise the script is great, the cast you're working with, the crew you're working with are great. So it was no pressure at all. He was able to turn up and do it.
And that's why the pilot is still his favourite episode. You know,
I was really shocked that he hadn't actually seen any more episodes than when he went to watch the pilot back, and then during the very final finale, he went to the premiere and watched that. But apart from that, he'd never seen any other episode of it. And, you know, that's crazy to know that he's missed out on this amazing series. I know he's been part of it, but he's not actually be able on the viewer's side and actually sit and watch the whole thing as a story unfold. But, you know, he's read the script and knows it all.
It was also quite interesting to hear his top three films as well. Clearly a bit of a Tarantino fan with Pulp Fiction and Dusk Till Dawn in there. And then Cheech and Chong as well, which is kind of made me laugh a bit as well.
That was an interesting suggestion. You don't hear that often in people's top movies, but yeah.
Especially those three together. he's clearly a fan of Dusk Till Dawn. He's a loves the TV series.
Although Cheech from Cheech and Chong is in from Dusk Till Dawn.
So there you go.
Maybe he's just a Cheech Marin fan.
Yeah, there we go. So it was interesting to hear that as well.
Okay, so RJ was very kind to give us a really cool prize that we're going to be giving away later in the show. I'm not going to say too much yet, but keep listening to the podcast, and later on we'll be giving away this very special RJ Mitty prize.
So during the Comic-Con, we got to speak to Ewan Kant, who is the marketing executive for Arrow Films. Now, I'm a huge fan of Arrow Films, so this was a great experience for me. If anyone hasn't ever checked out Arrow, please look at arrowfilms.co.uk. They distribute some of the really hard-to-find horrors, the cult-following titles, and they do hours and hours and hours into each package. The packaging's incredible, they do exclusive steelbooks, and trust me, their back cat is one of the best collections of movies out there. So here's the interview with Ewan.
I'm Ewan Kant. I work for Arrow on the Arrow video side, specifically. My main role is as a producer on some of our discs, mainly the horror titles. Being a huge horror fan, all the horror titles come my way. So that's the main thing that I do. And when I say producer, basically that means bringing all the elements together that constitutes the release. So that sort of starts with, you know, we acquire the title, you know, the next step normally is, you know, we commission the new artwork which we have on each of our releases, right through to commissioning extras, and that can be as involved as you want it to be, really. I've produced and directed some extras on an upcoming release, so I was really keen on that title, and then through to, you know, QCing the discs, watching through it, you know, following every step of the process, really.
So with Arrow having such a great collection of classics and obviously always looking out for the new titles, what's been your kind of finest release? I know myself would be Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2, just for the...
You say all the right things. Did you know that I produced that one?
No, not at all.
Okay, right. Yeah, that was actually... that's probably been my... There's been so many, but I mean, that was my first big project. I was actually given it my first week. I was told, you're working on Texas Chainsaw 2, and I was like, well...
It's everything, feel of the packaging, the artwork, the poster, the fold-out, everything about it, the love and care's gone into it. They deserved.
Yeah, well, no, I'm glad you say that. Yeah, we really put a lot of thought into these things. Texas Chainsaw 2, the artwork was really important, being sort of limited edition packaging, and I pretty much went straight with the artist, Justin Erickson, and he sent over a few concepts and a few different things. We actually ended up going for one which wasn't our favourite at first, but I think he really nailed it, how it came out, and it's something that just works really well across the package. Texas Chainsaw 2 was my first kind of big project. In terms of what I think personally is the finest project, or what's been like my...
Your personal favourite.
My personal favourite is Necromantic thus far. I don't know if any of you...
I've already pre-ordered the box set.
Excellent. Well,
before it sells out, with the soundtrack.
Yes, exactly, yeah. So that's, kind of using Chainsaw 2 as kind of a frame of reference. It's been a long journey with Necromantic. It was one when I started with Arrow about a year and a half ago. It was a title that was kind of being touted, and immediately I said, yeah, I'd love to do it. I just think it's a really unique, interesting film. And to a year and a half later to be releasing it uncut in the UK, it's just...
Were you surprised when they actually came back and gave it the full tick to do the full uncut version that everyone's wanted for years?
Not really, but only in the sense that it had already been shown at Leeds Film Festival 2 years before.
Yeah.
And it had been given a sort of tentative pass for that festival. Possibly helped by the fact that it's like a serious arts festival, and it wasn't kind of a scuzzy underground kind of thing. It was sort of being shown in a kind of a serious light, and for some reason that makes it more acceptable to people. So we already kind of knew, although like when I did actually submit it, they did hold out a little bit on giving the final classification. You have a thing called like the extranet on BBSC website where you go and check your submissions and what stage they're at, and then it got to like sort of pending at one point, and then I sort of started thinking, oh god, like we're going to have trouble with this. So I started calling them up and hounding them, and they just said, well, it means that when there's something like Necromantic where it's got it's kind of notorious, it's got a bit of a history, it has to be seen by first examiner, and then it has to be seen by like the senior examiner and then the president.
Yeah.
So it just meant that they were deferring it, for the president to have a proper look over it. But it did give me a bit of a fright.
I'm getting quite excited next month when that drops through the letterbox. It looks...
I don't know if it'll fit through the letterbox now.
No.
So I got a bit carried away with it, to be honest. The original idea was, which I really wanted to do, was VHS DVD Blu-ray combo.
Amazing!
Awesome. I know. Really, and also because kind of the hook for that was that it's never been released on VHS in the UK.
So you get
either.
All that half.
So it's, yeah, and that was kind of that was my original idea. Unfortunately, powers that be kind of that kind of reality kicked in, and I had it was turning out very difficult and expensive from a packaging point of view, trying to fit all those elements together and make it work and feel all of a piece.
Yeah.
So we ended up... I'm really, really happy with what we ended up with. Got an artist called Gilles Vranckx. He's done a couple of bits for us. He's done Pit and the Pendulum and Blind Woman's Curse. And, just to give you an insight into, how much kind of... How close, we are... producers are to their individual projects. Me and the artist sat and had an hour Skype conversation about how we, our thoughts on the film and how what the art should, what elements should be in the art and how the art should feel. And
it's nice to know you had that much control as well, and overall everyone got the same. It wasn't someone
passion
telling.
As well. Yeah. Seems to be really kind of
I love my Necromantic. Yeah, but
who doesn't?
Exactly. Yeah, but we were really, I was really invested in that project.
How involved have you been with the expansion into the US?
Not hugely myself. It's obviously quite it's been a while in gestation. The Kickstarter went live a couple of months ago. As we kind of added new titles to the slate, it suddenly just took off, and we ended up going over our...
In such a short time, it was amazing. You must be quite honoured that the fact that every fan seems to back it and want you to do well, and within a few weeks you'd hit your target.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, you never, you know, I think we're reasonably confident, but you never quite know when you go with something like this. But yeah, it was just astounding, and you know, it just shows kind of the thinking behind it, the reasoning behind it wasn't. Yeah, it was well judged, I guess.
So with Arrow titles mostly being horror, that's what a lot of people go to the horror section for. When you'd announced stuff like Porky's and The Burbs most recently, that was quite a shock to see titles. I know they're still kind of, especially The Burbs, it's horror, but it's a lot more mainstream. It wasn't that title you've always wanted that you had on video that you couldn't get.
Mm.
What was the decision to go with those sort of major kind of titles?
I just think Arrow has always been, you know, reasonably diverse.
Yeah.
You know, there was still, you know, the initial kind of Video Nasty titles, but even if you go back right to the start of Arrow Video a few years back, we did Kentucky Fried Movie. You know, it's always been pretty diverse. You know, anything that kind of really comes under the banner of cult. You know, I think, you know, I personally, I'm a huge horror fan, but you know, it's not the only thing I like.
No,
it is my main area. But you know, Burbs was a big VHS classic for me when I was a kid.
Yeah.
You know, and I think there's room for, you know, all kinds of things under the Arrow Video banner. You know, I think, I mean, I suppose you know, Burbs is probably one of the more mainstream we've done. But we did Burbs, and then suddenly we pulled Necromantic out of the bag.
Yeah.
You know, which was, I mean, I thought that was, I was particularly happy that we did that, just because it's kind of, you know, it's sort of, you know, like you say, done some more mainstream titles, and it's kind of really taking it back to kind of the real sort of grimy, you know, kind of, I suppose you'd say, the roots of kind of Arrow Video, like The House by the Cemetery, Macabre, and things like that. You know, it's kind of shows that we're still willing to stick our necks out and kind of go with something.
So, what would you class as your top three horrors then of all time?
Top three horrors of all time.
We had this in a recent episode, it's hard work.
No, it's easy. Texas Chainsaw Massacre, Last House on the Left, and Hills Have Eyes.
Brilliant.
Knows what he likes.
I mean, that's always been, you know, I've got like a top 10 that's kind of.
Yeah, any John Carpenter in the top 10? The Thing? Halloween?
Yeah, I mean, the thing with things like Halloween and stuff is, I guess it's kind of obvious, so I don't think immediately it tends to be stuff that. I mean, Chainsaw, Last House on the Left, and Hills Have Eyes have just always been films that have really resonated with me. And Halloween has to be in my top 10 for sure.
I think it's illegal actually to leave it out. It's the golden rule.
Yeah, yeah. It's just because it's like so obvious that almost kind of
you kind of want to leave it out.
No one really argues with that. You get some people arguing with Texas Chainsaw Massacre. You get some people arguing with Last House on the Left and Hills Have Eyes as well, for various reasons.
One final question, so I don't want to keep it too long. With these steelbooks now being such a kind of collector's item, people are really jumping on the bandwagon of collecting these titles, so it's great to see you do Porky's and Phantom and Invasion of the Body Snatchers and taking the time out to do it. Is that something that you can want to continue with all your releases now? Try and get a standard steelbook as well as the normal packaging? Are you going to try that more?
It really depends on the title.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really on the bigger titles. I mean, steelbooks are costly to produce. There's, you know, there's only one company that you can do them through, and so it really has to be a Burbs or
Black Sunday.
You know, it has to be a big enough title to kind of warrant that, really. So, you know, where
possible,
we think
can,
there's kind of the demand for it.
Any exclusive titles you can tell us about that are coming?
We're announcing our January, February titles this week.
Anything exclusive?
I mean, stuff that we've already teased through the postcards, but people don't know the actual release date. So we're going to have Rabid coming out.
Nice.
Comedy of Terrors, which is a Vincent Price title. Those are two I'm working on, so those are the two that are at the forefront of my thoughts. That's all I can say, really, for the moment.
Basket Case, is that coming?
And it's already been done by Second Sight. It's a trilogy,
it.
They picked us to the post there. I would have loved to have done that. All I can say is that there's just, you know, if you're a horror fan in the UK, you know, there's some titles next year that, you know, you'd be
good very, times ahead there.
Very happy with. And there's a little teaser, I'd say there's one particular horror franchise that we're going to dip into next year that I think a lot of people will be happy with. And that will be teased soon by way of postcards, so that should be out quite... the word should be out about that soon enough.
Thank you.
We were also lucky enough to speak to legendary artist Graham Humphreys.
So here we are with Graham Humphreys, the fantastic artist who has artwork featured for Evil Dead, Evil Dead 2, Inferno, along with lots and lots of other Arrow titles. So, first of all, how's your day going at the Comic-Con today?
Very well, thank you very much. I've sold a few prints, done some work, and been chatting quite a lot to various people.
Fantastic. So, as an artist yourself, who have you kind of took inspiration from? I know you probably get this question a lot, but who's the artist that you've looked up to that's made you get into drawing this sort of art?
Well, probably when I was young, without knowing who the names were, it's the work of people like Drew Struzan and Bob Peake. And then I loved all the posters for the disaster movies, Earthquake, Towering Inferno, and that's really probably what inspired me.
Fantastic. And
is that something you actively researched as you got older then? Did you like the artwork as a child, not really knowing who did them, and then you actively went out and researched them?
Well, I came to realise, the signature is Drew Struzan and Bob Peake quite a lot, so those were familiar names, but okay. It's only... researching for a talk about 4 years ago, I started looking at all the other artists, and then a lot of people didn't sign their work, so it's kind of hard trying to find all those original artists, and you realise actually this whole body of work out there has been done by about half a dozen people. And obviously in Britain we had the artist Tom Chantrell, who did a lot of the Hammer stuff and Carry On films and things like that, and his work is just everywhere. It certainly was everywhere.
So with the artwork films such as Zombie Flesh Eaters, how did that come about? Did they approach you and ask for certain?
That was done for Death Vault Recording Company. So Spencer approached me independently. That was the first release I think they did on his new label. And then because Arrow were releasing their own DVD Blu-ray, they actually just asked if they could use the artwork.
Fantastic. And what's some of your top personal favourite horror movies?
Oh, God. It changes daily. Yeah. But the ones I do go back to, things like actually Lord of Illusions I really love. I always go back to Hammer films, and I think films like Dracula's Risen from the Grave, you just can't beat those. I think it's such fantastic pieces of work, and just in terms of colour, mood, lighting, acting, neither here nor there. But there's a bit of magic with Christopher Lee and Peter Cushing when they're in a film together. It always works.
Nobody else can recreate that now. I think the problem with horror now, they don't get it right.
No. I think people do a lot of homage stuff, but they don't actually seem to originate.
No.
Even the editor of the Astron 6 film, it's obviously a homage to Barber and Argento. I mean, they've tried to do something quite fresh with it, and actually is a very, very funny film as well. But again, I guess you're kind of looking at pastiche in a way, and I think you have to look to... the Spanish and the Germans.
Yeah.
It seems like all the Euro stuff is actually where the original material is now. It's certainly not America. The Fright Fest this year, for instance, I mean, it seems to be, I think New Zealand had the two freshest, most interesting films, Housebound and Babadook.
Did you see the Babadook?
I loved it, yeah.
How good was that film?
Fantastic.
At last they're getting horror right, but again, it's not America.
And it's a smart film. It's not just... merely a horror film. It's stuff
more psychological instead.
Yeah.
This is it. I mean, America looked to start recreating horror a lot during the early noughties. When you look at The Ring, they started looking at things like that instead of coming up with their own concepts again.
Absolutely,
yeah.
There's a lot of theft going on.
Yes.
Out of all your amazing pieces of work, I mean, obviously Evil Dead, Evil Dead 2, the biggest films. What's your personal favourite piece of work that you're most proud of that you've done?
Well, I guess the piece which I'm still happy with is probably Nightmare 2.
Yeah.
And because I love Hammer films, I'm really happy with that piece as well. But...
Fantastic.
Is there anything that you're working on at the minute that you could tell us about?
I'm doing this... It's a fake poster for... They Call Her One Eye, which I'm doing for a client in Sweden as a private commission. I've got some stuff to do for Arrow, but I can't tell you what those are.
Does that go inside with their US releases or UK?
I think one of them is going to be one of the first dual releases, yeah.
Fantastic. We really appreciate your time today, and thank you.
Thank you so much.
Couple of really interesting interviews there. And I know, Mark, as you've said, you're a big fan of Arrow, and I wasn't too familiar with their work, not being a huge fan of horror. But it was especially interesting listening to you and talking about how the packages are put together.
Yeah, I mean, it's incredible to see how much of an input he actually gets. So the fact that he could have decided on the fact of a VHS maybe going into this actual package, a DVD, the soundtrack, but even the steelbook production and what artwork they get to choose and how they go to independent artists and get to select these certain pieces specifically just for that Arrow release, even if it wasn't the original cinema or even the DVD original release, they actually get it just for that one film.
Yeah, when he was talking about the VHS, DVD and sort of Blu-ray combination package, that was awesome. It was great to
I wish we could have got that.
Yeah, it's just the way, because he said it was never released on VHS, so the idea was to try and get it out there on VHS.
And even though no one in this day and age is going to watch the VHS, as part of a collector's package, that'd be really, really cool.
And that's what Arrow seemed like to me. They seem like a distribution company that really is for the hardcore fans.
Yeah.
They're really looking after the best interests of those guys.
Yeah, I'll tell that to my bank balance.
It was also great to hear from Graham Humphreys there, the artist who's done a lot of work with Arrow as well.
Yeah, and to see some of his work, because he was sat there at his booth actually making art as he went along, which is up on his website now, and there's a link to that on our website. So it was really cool to see him work as well as to speak to him about his work.
I think a lot of people don't realise how much artwork he's actually done as well until we went through his portfolio there.
Yeah.
I'm not just saying Evil Dead 1 and 2, but he actually got involved with Basket Case, he did some of their artwork. He's done a lot of those cult posters he's behind, which you don't even realise. And he's a British artist, so it's
great. And Nightmare, too.
Yeah, Nightmare on Elm Street 2, fantastic.
You can see a lot of Graham's work over on his website, which is grahamhumphreys.com. And Mark, you're also going to Instagram a picture of what you got from him. What was that?
Yeah, the Evil Dead 2 poster, and I've got him to sign it, and it's an absolute gorgeous piece of artwork, and it's actually in Spaced as well in one of the scenes, so a lot of people remember it from that. So yeah, it's beautiful, and we'll get that on Instagram, which is Skip to the End Podcast. So on the subject of horror, while we're at the Comic-Con, we got to meet the guys from Headshot Clothing.
Yeah.
Now, these are an independent supplier of T-shirts and designer. Really nice guys to chat to.
Yeah.
And yeah, really nice.
What caught my attention was they had this amazing artwork for Halloween and also The Thing, which is one of my favourite films. But did you see the designs, guys? I mean, they're really unique and some kind cool, of original ideas.
Some cool Walking Dead ones as well.
Yeah, sort of self-designed T-shirts, really unique. And I thought they had a lot of cool stuff.
We were lucky enough to get one of the Thing T-shirts. I actually bought one myself. I'll put a picture up on our Twitter, which is at STTE Podcast. But we've actually got one of these to give away. So the guys from Headshot were lucky enough to give us this. So if you'd like to win this, all we want you to do is tweet us or Facebook us and tell us who directed The Thing, and you can win one of these kick-ass T-shirts.
Following on from our MCM London Comic Con special, which you can find on skiptotheend.co.uk, where we were able to interview Grace, Mackenzie and Aisha from Under the Dome, we've actually been able to speak to Colin Ford from Under the Dome as well this time. So here's the interview.
So this is Mark from Skip to the End. I'm just interviewing today Colin Ford from the Stephen King series Under the Dome. So how's it going in England for you today?
It's going. We're having a great time here at the MCM Comic Con. The turnout is incredible. We have so many different people, so many crazy costumes. Everybody's here checking out their favorite video game or favorite TV show, actor or actress, and it's a blast. We're having a good time.
Is this your first time in England? Or
this is my second time in England, and I love it so much. That's why I had to come out. I spent 4 days in West London before I came up to Birmingham. Loved every minute of it.
Fantastic. So with the success of Under the Dome, and now it's going into season 3, which is great news.
Yeah, thank you.
When you studied for this, did you read the book, or have you...
Well, I approached after finding out that I was going to be playing the role of Joe, I kind of went into do some more research for the character, and I asked the writers, I said, how are we going to be are we going to be deviating from the novel? What's our path? And they told me, yes, we're going to be doing things quite a bit different. And I didn't want to read Joe as a character in Stephen King's novel, fall in love with the character, and not get to play him that way on screen because of the way that the scripts were given to me.
Fantastic. Have you read any other Stephen King books that you'd love to be in if they ever made an adaptation for a film? Is there any other ones that you've read, or quite new to Stephen King?
I'm quite new to Stephen King after being a part of Under the Dome, but I've read The Mist, but they've already made
it. How great is that film?
It's fantastic.
Apart from the ending, it's so bleak.
Right. Well, it's, I think it's just, you know, that car ride at the end is pretty sad.
Yeah, it's very good. So what we do on this podcast, we always discuss our top three, so our top three films, our TV.
Okay.
Do you want to give the listeners a bit of an insight to your top three current TV series that you watch?
Well, top three would probably be I'm watching Orange is the New Black with my girlfriend.
Brilliant.
And I'm watching, I was watching Breaking Bad, just finished that.
Have you finished the whole
thing? I finally finished the whole thing. And then, oddly enough, I need to finish the current season of Walking Dead.
Amazing.
So,
good taste.
As well as Supernatural, which is a show that I'm on, but occasionally.
Fantastic. So I'm a big fan of Cameron Crowe, and I know you're in, obviously, We Bought a Zoo.
As am I. I'm a huge fan of his.
How was it working with him?
He's incredible.
I mean, yeah.
My favorite thing that Cameron would do, aside from any other director I've ever worked with, is he would incorporate music into filming. He would set up speakers and wire them all across our set, which was huge. We had a 500-acre ranch that we shot on, so he had wireless speakers everywhere. And he would play music in order to set the tone for the day, whatever scenes we did for the day. He would play music throughout the entire day. When the cameras were rolling, he would still be playing music just soft enough so the mics wouldn't pick it up, but loud enough to where we could hear it. And it would just set the tone and the mood and just kind of bring a feeling in you that talking or rehearsing the script just can't.
Whenever he brings a film out, it's literally the soundtrack you want to own, like almost famous afterwards. It must be incredible to work with him.
Every soundtrack is incredible. Like the We Bought a Zoo soundtrack is great.
Amazing.
Yeah, it's really, really good. I downloaded it on my iPod.
Fantastic. So how long were you on set for that film? Was it a long process?
5.5 months.
Wow.
It was a big, big stretch.
So it's a beautiful film.
Thank you. I love the
story. I love the acting. The cast is fantastic. But anything that he's done is fantastic.
I agree. And you know, having Matt Damon for a father at age 13, 14 when I shot it, was just the dream come true.
And working with Scarlett Johansson.
Oh yeah, she's beautiful.
She is the most beautiful woman in the world.
She is.
Obviously after your girlfriend.
After my girlfriend.
Yeah, make sure you get that in.
I definitely have to say it. No.
So what's your plans for the rest? Are you staying in England for a bit longer, or are you going straight back?
Going back home after the weekend, unfortunately. But like I said, was able to spend some time in West London before coming up to Birmingham. So got to do a little bit of shopping and sightseeing and do the London Eye and such.
Amazing.
Yeah,
you had a great time.
Oh, I did. It was really, really fun. I know my girlfriend loved it as well.
That's really good that you got to bring your girlfriend and have all this experience while doing work.
Yes, absolutely.
And overall, what would you say to the people of MCM? Have you had a really good time in Comic-Cons?
This is my second one, and I'm so happy to be back and ready to be back for more if they're willing to invite me.
So that was our interview with Colin Ford from Under the Dome. I'm starting to think that we should be the official podcast of Under the Dome, the amount of their cast members that we've interviewed now. I know that was a particularly interesting interview for you, Mark.
Yeah, I mean, to get to discuss away from Under the Dome, actually discuss We Bought a Zoo, which is Cameron Crowe film, which is a great film and one of my personal favourites. So it was just great to speak to him and hear about his time on set. And I never knew that Cameron Crowe played music while the actors were actually acting.
It's very interesting
scenes.
To hear,
it's very rare to hear about that, but it obviously works because he's one of the directors that gets unbelievable performances out of all of his actors. So, yeah, it's a really, really good conversation with him and such a nice guy.
Yeah, seemed like a really cool kid. We also attended a panel for upcoming British sci-fi film The Call-Up, written and directed by award-winning commercials director Charles Barker. The film tells the story about a bunch of gamers who are brought in to test new high-tech equipment in virtual reality. They soon find out that this isn't virtual reality and they're fighting a very real war. On the panel were several members of the cast and producer John Giwu Amu, and he told us about how the project came together.
It won the Brit Fest, which is kind of the hottest screenplays in the UK, movies, you know, don't always get made straight away after that, but we made it pretty quickly. That was obviously a massive mark of confidence for the script, but, you know, it's a unique concept. It's a concept that feels like you've seen it before, but you actually haven't. And, you know, that's what drew me to it.
One of the stars of the film is Max Deacon. He was also in Into the Storm early this year, and this is what he had to say about his role.
I'm talking to the director, Charles, about his ambitions for the project, which, yeah, he was kind of referencing films like Alien and stuff like that, and talking about a film which is obviously is kind of a sci-fi horror, but that really focuses on interesting characters and real people and how they react in these slightly surreal but not that far-fetched circumstances. I think it is. It's a kind of film for modern times. Like, I don't know if anyone's ever done that Oculus Rift, but is you might even have somewhere around here. I don't know, but it really isn't that far away.
Parker Sawyers has been in Zero Dark Thirty and will also be seen in the upcoming Monsters Dark Continent, and here are his thoughts on the call-up.
I think what drew me to the script and the project is the focus on technology and the way the technology moves so fast nowadays. It seems like what happens in the movie is not too far off from what could happen very near in the future. And as far as Andre, he's a former soldier, and he goes into this world. He's sort of a leader, and he tries to do the best he can with the crew. And I think it was interesting for the characters to work within this new technology and something that could be harrowing and scary.
During the panel, we were also treated to a sneak preview of some scenes from the film. So, Mark, what did you think?
Yeah, it looked a really interesting film, and it was nice to see it was filmed in Birmingham.
Yeah.
It was great to actually see the suit that they brought along from the movie, and the design and the concept looks really interesting.
Yeah, we didn't see a lot of footage because they're actually still filming, so they managed to put together some footage exclusively for the con. But what they showed does definitely look interesting.
Yeah, it was a very interesting concept. I mean, it seems like, because it's set in a virtual reality world and a real world, like the virtual reality world is the one that seems very gritty and grainy, whereas the real world looks very pristine and clean. And it'd be interesting to see how they kind of juxtapose those two worlds.
So look out for the call-up in cinemas next year. I, like millions of people around the world, am a huge Game of Thrones fan, so it was a big thrill for me to get to interview Ian McElhenney. So we're here with Ian McElhenney, known to fans of Game of Thrones as Sir Barristan Selmy. So Ian, thanks a lot for joining us.
My pleasure, thank you for coming to talk to me.
Thank you. So were you familiar with the Game of Thrones books before you actually took the role in
the
show?
No, I knew nothing about the fact that it was based on books.
Okay.
But as soon as I found out, I started reading the books and enjoyed them hugely. To be honest, much more than I thought I would, because I didn't think of myself as somebody who was that taken with fantasy.
Yeah.
But once I got into the books, I couldn't put them down, because I thought they were incredibly well written and very entertaining and a great read. But also, I was just overwhelmed, as I think most of us are, by the sheer scale of the imagination and the plotting and the structuring of the storylines. So it was a real pleasure to read them, so I really enjoyed that.
And what did you think to your character, to Barristan Selmy?
I was happy with the character that I landed, because, first of all, he stayed alive, which was kind of good, because, you know, in this story a lot of people die, and I personally, as an actor, have a history of getting killed off and things, so I was delighted that for once it wasn't happening. And I like the fact that he's, in that story, he's relatively an unusual character in that he is genuinely an honourable man, and there ain't many of them about. So it was nice to play somebody of that type, which is kind of in contrast to most of the characters in the story. You know?
So having not read any books or anything going into it, what was it that attracted you to the role when it was available?
Well, when I went in, I remember reading a scene which I really enjoyed as a scene, and I thought, well, this is, you know, evidence of what the character's going to have to deal with, or the kind of person that he is. I like the feel of this. But also, you know, when you get involved in something, now, none of us knew necessarily it was going to have the huge impact that it's had, but when you get involved in something that is being done by HBO, you kind of know that it will be done very professionally, because HBO does, I think it's fair to say, make the best TV of anybody at the moment, certainly in the English language. So, you know, no actor is really going to sort of, like, you know, thumb his nose at you know, something coming from that stable, you know.
So, given that, at what point did you realise how big this series was actually becoming?
Well, I guess in a funny sort of way, you knew already in the very first year that it was going to be quite substantial, if only because, although it was costing a lot of money to make the series, there was a rumour going around about the level to which it had pre-sold. So you were very conscious of the fact that this looks like it's going to have a very high visibility. That's the first thing. I guess after a couple of years, probably even after the first season, you knew that it had a huge following, and it's just grown and grown and grown since then.
It did kind of take off straight away.
Yeah, yeah. And, I mean, you know from your own experience in that, you know, I've done loads of telly over the years, but I could walk down the street and nobody would bother me, you know what I mean? Having done this, what you find happens more is that, you know, out of the blue, people recognize you and are saying, you know, give us an autograph, do a selfie with us, whatever, you know. And you could be anywhere in the world and that could be happening. And if I'm honest, that kind of thing wasn't happening before. So, you know, that's one of those things.
You know? With you being in telly yourself for many years and with the success of this series, are there any other series that you watch religiously that have drawn you, like for us, Game of Thrones has?
You know, I don't know if it's a busman's holiday or what. I love drama. I love doing it. And if I happen to watch something, I can quite often get hooked on something. But I'm not an avid watcher. I tend to find... thank God that I'm usually pretty busy or running around somewhere, so I tend not to be able to follow things. And I'm, although the obvious way now to watch stuff, especially for somebody like me, would be box sets or Netflix or whatever, you know, I find that I'm not very good at saying, oh, I'm going to spend, you know, all of today or half of today watching 3 or 4 hours of such and such. So there's lots of things that I'm sure are brilliant that I've never seen. There's lots of things where I've managed to see an episode or two and thought that's really good, but I haven't actually followed it, you know. So I find it kind of bizarre myself that there's so much good TV out there that I haven't
got locked into. It's a good thing that you've got enough going on that you're not sitting there for 10 hours watching
Yes,
business.
It is.
That's a good thing.
It is a good thing, you know, and I mean, I'm quite happy with that, but I'm sure I'm missing out on some really good stuff because, you know, there's so many programs you hear. That's a really good series,
well,
you know.
And are you allowed to tell us whether you've been filming for the upcoming season?
Oh, absolutely, yes. I have been filming for season 5. I finished my filming for this year now, about a month ago, in fact. But it is still going on. The filming season for Game of Thrones is really about 6 months, usually sort of like mid-July through to early December. And... my unit, partly because it's been involved in a warm weather climate, tends to fall pretty well regularly in September, October, because it's the end of the summer season in Med, but it's still warm.
Yeah.
It's not as mad as it is, especially in August. So it's a good time for them to go and film there. Once the weather turns, you know, the weather becomes more unpredictable there too. So, you know, that's usually when we tend to film, you know. So my unit is pretty predictably September, October, you know.
So do we have a lot to look forward to?
You have a lot to look forward to. I tell you, this next year is full of surprises. There's things that happen in pretty well every episode that I know of. There's major things that happen. And there will be things where you're saying, I can't believe they've done that. You know, I mean, that's
even,
the great...
Even for Game of Thrones, you can't believe it.
Well, that's the great thing about Game of Thrones. It is so unpredictable in a way, you know. And there's, they do sort of have a very strong sense that, you know, this is what keeps this series really kind of up there, is the fact that it keeps surprising people. It keeps sort of like, I guess, sometimes removing characters that you don't expect to go, you know, things like that. So there's a constant kind of excitement in that, you know.
We've spoken to a number of actors today that have actually, you know, from Breaking Bad and other series, that have actually confessed that they never watched back any of the series once they filmed it.
Yeah.
Have you gone back after filming and watched so far up-to-date episode, or have you just...
No, I'm like a lot of other people. I know the story because I know the books. I don't follow the series. And the only reason I don't is... You know, I don't even know, because I didn't start to watch it. And because I didn't start to watch it, I kept saying, oh, I'll get round to it sometime. And then it was like, oh, I'll get round to it another time, and another time, and another time. So what I've seen is almost incidental. I've seen clips from various things. I've obviously seen things when I've gone in to do ADR in the studio. I did this year see all of, and it's the only time I've seen a full episode, I saw all of the first episode of season 4 because I was at a few of the launches and therefore saw that. I feel I know it back to front, although I haven't actually watched it, you know, and I feel possibly the way it's going to work now is there will come a point whenever I know I am out of it, when I'll probably be able to sit down and really enjoy it with detachment, you know, because I'll be watching it as something that I don't feel I'm invested in the same way anymore, you know. So it's not uncommon for actors not to watch.
It doesn't seem to be,
because sometimes it's hard to watch yourself. Sometimes, I don't know, just from my own experience as a younger actor, I didn't always find it easy, but I would try and watch myself, if only to sort of see what kind of quirks. Everybody has quirks, and you have quirks and you think, oh, I don't like that, I should try and do something about it. So you try and iron certain things out.
Yeah.
But as time has gone on and I've done more, you find something's gone through and you haven't happened to see it, and you just say, well, don't worry about it, you didn't see that one, and the more time goes on, the less I happen to see, but there's no agenda attached to it as such anymore. It's just the way it is.
I highly recommend you watch it. Game of Thrones is really good.
Oh no, I'm looking forward to it.
At
some point I will do it. I got a nephew who works as one of the drivers of Game of Thrones, and he's a fanatical film, TV watcher, and he has in his house, he has a huge, the whole wall of one room that is dedicated to watching things is given over to a very large screen, and he has a projector and the whole works, and he religiously sort of gets box sets of things and files and all the rest. So I do know that when the time comes, I can sit in that room of his and just, binge, if I want, on Game of Thrones on a large screen for a few days. So who knows?
Wait till it's finished and do the whole lot over 2 weeks.
Well,
just don't leave.
That's what I might end up doing, we shall see.
I really enjoyed that interview and I geeked out quite a bit because, as I said, I'm a huge Game of Thrones fan and I love Sir Barristan Selmy. He's not a huge character in the books or the show, but he's quite a pivotal one. He plays an important role. I don't want to say too much, Adam, because I know you're not fully up on your Game of Thrones.
No, I can't say I am. I'm not really well-versed in Game of Thrones.
You're missing a trick there, boy. You need to get involved. I love the TV show. I've read all the books. Can't wait for the next one whenever George R.R. Martin puts it out. But it was really cool to meet Ian McElhenney, and he's so different from his character. Ian was like just a real gentleman. He's got that softly spoken Irish accent, whereas Sir Barristan Selmy was the leader of the King's Guard and the best swordsman in all the land, and it was really weird to see what he was like in real life, but great fun for me.
He seemed like a really nice guy, talking to him. He was very kind of up on his Game of Thrones, as you heard as well. Like, he hadn't actually watched the series, but he'd ended up reading all the books and absolutely loved them.
Yeah.
Again, I find it fascinating that we speak to these actors on these really big, successful TV series, and again, he's never watched an episode in his life, so it's just crazy. But he did admit, unlike RJ, that when it finishes, he is going to binge out and, I think, do the whole lot. I think he said in his nephew's house with a big cinema screen. And
he kind of said when he's done, didn't he? So he obviously knows for George R.R. Martin's penance for killing off characters quite a lot. So he's obviously projecting his own downfall at some point.
Yeah, everybody dies in Game of Thrones.
Yeah,
everybody. Sorry, spoiler alert, everybody dies.
So I think he's just taking that role now of, when I'm out of it, I'll start watching it then.
Yeah. So really pleasant to meet Ian.
Okay then, lads, so it's that time again. Let's talk about our top three moments of the con itself. So who wants to go first? Mark?
Yeah, for me, at number three, it would be, the Headshot T-shirt company.
Very cool.
I thought the guys we actually spoke to from there were really, really nice guys. Really interesting to see this independent designer go out and try and make a living and really put all of his effort and heart into it. And you could see the amount of detail and his T-shirts. So anyone that's listening to this, go and check out the website, because honestly, some of those designs are unbelievable, especially for a nerd like me.
We've mentioned it before, but it is headshot.clothing.
Yeah, headshot.clothing. And you mentioned, Adam, one of their Walking Dead designs.
Yeah,
and awesome. I believe that the chap from the store said they were going to do a Walking Dead-specific convention in Germany.
Yeah.
So I think those T-shirts are going to go like hotcakes. So yeah, I really like those guys and their designs too. My number three would be the whole memorabilia element of it. I think the whole Birmingham Con has grown out of the memorabilia stands that were at the NEC previously. So you've still got all those stalls with your old original 1970s and early 80s Star Wars figures and that sort of stuff. So I love all that,
Autograph
books.
Luis Suarez, Rio Ferdinand, Billy Idol.
I don't know why you'd want Luis Suarez, but that's fine. But there's a lot of good stuff there. So much Pokemon merchandise.
Pikachus everywhere,
there's Pikachus practically everywhere.
As I pointed out to you.
constantly. Yeah. So yeah, the memorabilia, the stalls, just everything. There's so much to see and do, so much to buy. I bought a really couple of cool art prints, both based on the Joker, which are now framed up on my wall, and I'm very happy with those. So much good stuff.
Well, third for me, and it's a bit of a strange one, but there's a whole like Street Fighter stand.
Yeah.
There were loads of different Street Fighter t-shirts, which I really enjoyed. And the icing on the cake for that stand for me was a little Street Fighter 2 turbo version arcade machine they had.
Oh, yeah.
It was original awesome. Arcade proper machine. Original arcade machine. And there's some cool shirts on the stand as well. So I had a look around that, and then I just basically spent a lot of time playing the Street Fighter arcade machine.
And we've also got a picture of it up on our Instagram, which is...
Skip to the End Podcast.
Awesome. So, Mark, number two.
Probably getting to actually meet Graham Humphreys. I've got a number of steel books with his artwork on. I've got a number of his normal Blu-rays and DVDs. I've always been a massive fan of Evil Dead and Evil Dead 2. The artwork's iconic. Fantastic guy. You know, when you meet one of your heroes, it's really great that they're everything you hope they'd be.
Yeah, absolutely.
And just such a nice guy. Really good conversation with him. And, you know, which I'll show on Twitter and Facebook. I was lucky enough to get a couple of his original prints signed. And, well, that's for me, treasure. So, couldn't ask for a nicer guy to meet.
Definitely. He was a really nice guy as well. Very genuine.
Yeah. And speaking of nice guys, my number two choice is Ian McElhenney. As I've said already a couple of times, I'm a huge Game of Thrones fan. Getting to meet someone from the cast at all was very cool for me. But getting to meet Sir Barristan Selmy himself, a guy who I really, really dig on the show, was very cool. So I was very happy that he was there to speak to us.
Well, number two for me, I'm actually going to go down the route of Comic Village.
Yeah.
I was very impressed, actually. A lot of people can go to these cons and not really check out the Comic Village, but I do recommend it. There's a lot of kind of independent artists there who do some fantastic work. I mean, there's a few stands there that will draw you, like you as a manga character and stuff like that, for a bit of money. And it was really impressive to walk down and see some of the art on display. And these, you've got to remember, some of these guys are kind of like not that well-known artists. Mm. Some of them are quite independent, so really good to see some of their work on the showcase.
It was, and as you say, some of these people are unknown and up-and-coming. And the age of some of them, there was a couple of girls who were running a stand who I'm sure were sort of 14 or 15, yeah. And their artwork was fantastic. So it's great that they were able to go out there and show their work, as well as the professionals or the people who have been in the industry a long time.
Mm. I think what's really interesting is the fact that when we go back in 4 or 5 years, those people are going to be the people that are doing signings. I wouldn't be surprised if we've got future talent there.
Could well be. So if you do go to these cons and you've never really checked out the Comic Village, I do recommend it.
Yeah, highly.
Agreed.
So Mark, number one then?
For me, it's got to be RJ Mitty. I absolutely adore Breaking Bad, and I was a little bit starstruck meeting him. Yeah. Like, he's a legend, really nice guy. What an interview, and, you know, it's RJ Mitty.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. That's my number one as well. RJ, Walt Jr., Flynn himself, cool to meet him. It is my favourite TV show of all time, so I was just really jazzed to meet the guy, and he didn't let me down. He was so cool, so friendly, so happy. Loved him.
I'm just frantically trying to think of something else for number one now, because I also have RJ Mitty.
That's fine.
But I can't think of anything at the con that was better than him. He was such a nice guy, as we've said before. He was so fun to meet. And he's really funny. I mean, there's some stuff that he said kind of as he was leaving the press rooms and stuff that we didn't get on record, unfortunately. But, you know, he mentioned about going into stand-up comedy and some bits about that with his friends have been telling him how funny he is. And you could see it happening, because he is a really funny guy when you get to know him.
I'd be the first in the queue for tickets. And he said how he has quite a dark sense of humour. So we love that over in Britain, don't we?
He'd
so
do very well over here with that kind of humour. So number one for me as well, RJ.
Speaking of RJ Mitty, I think it's time for the competition to win an exclusive RJ Mitty prize. RJ gave us a signed picture of himself, and it's a really, really cool prize. On the panel, one of the things that was discussed was how Walt Jr. always seemed to be eating breakfast. This is one of those things that people laugh about and joke about. Why is Walt always eating breakfast? So someone asked him on the panel, why is this the case? And RJ said, actually, I don't eat breakfast as often as you would think. I actually only ate breakfast this amount of times. So that's the question. How many times did RJ Mitty, Walt Jr. eat breakfast on Breaking Bad?
You can enter this competition by simply tweeting us your answer. We're at STTE Podcast. You can also visit our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/skiptotheendpodcast. And if you'd like to email us your answer, it's skiptotheend@icloud.com. This also goes for the competition we mentioned earlier. You can win from the great guys at Headshot Clothing a t-shirt of The Thing. To win this amazing t-shirt, all you simply have to do is let us know who directed The Thing. Easy, easy question.
Good luck.
So on the MCM Comic-Con London special, we offered our listeners a chance to win a signed Lizzie Bennet Diaries poster signed by Mary-Kate Wiles. So the question for that was, which Jane Austen novel is the Lizzie Bennet Diaries based on? So we've had a few answers come in, which is great. And the correct answer actually is Pride and Prejudice. So, Mark, who is our winner?
Via Twitter, Phoebe, who is at 5oddsocks. So congratulations.
Congratulations, Phoebe.
And that brings us to the end of our MCM Birmingham Comic-Con special. We want to say a big thank you to Gary, Josh and Dave for getting us access to the event. We had a great time, didn't we, lads?
Yeah, it was really cool.
Incredible.
And we'll see you at the next one.